Today's program has been brought to you by Taggart Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit taggartinn.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome. Today is the day for What Doesn't Kill You. Lost my stuff there for a second. What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. And today we're going to have a really interesting show. We have two guests. They will both be on the phone. Thus, if there are any problems with them hearing each other, I will be obliged to repeat some of the information. But I think it's all going to be good. What we have today is, I hope, what will be a really robust debate on something that is called the King Amendment, but which really is the Protect Interstate Commerce Act, which was introduced by Representative Stephen King of Iowa into the Farm Bill not so long ago. And so my guests today are representing the agricultural industry, Brian Klippenstein, who is the executive director of Protect the Harvest, an education and advocacy group founded by Forrest Lucas of Lucas Oil in 2010 to work with leaders of agriculture to stand up for animal production and affordable food. And on the other side of the debate is the excellent John Goodwin from Humane Society of United States. And John is the director of animal cruelty policy for HSUS Animal Rescue Team. He is a nationally recognized expert on animal fighting issues and has been involved in the passage of legislation at both state and federal levels to curb animal fighting. Welcome both of you gentlemen to the program. Thank you so much for joining me today on Sunday. So we're talking about the King Amendment. And before we go any further, I'm going to actually read the words, because the King Amendment, despite its sort of far-reaching consequences, is a very short little amendment. And so since many of our listeners who probably have not read it but may have read some coverage of it, I'm just going to give people basically what it says, which is the following. The Constitution of the United States, the government of a state or locality therein, shall not impose a standard or condition on the production of manufacture of any agricultural product sold or offered for sale in interstate commerce. If such production or manufacture occurs in another state and the standard or condition is in addition to the standards and conditions applicable to such production or manufacture pursuant to federal law and the laws of state and locality in which such production or manufacture occurs. So, John, I'm going to ask you to translate that.
Well, sure. Well, it's very simple. It's an amendment that would prohibit any state or locality from setting a standard or a condition for agriculture products. Now, the big question is, what does that mean?
Yes.
And that's where things get pretty complicated, mm-hmm. because some people interpret this very narrowly. Other people interpret it more broadly. And I think that's one of the real weaknesses with this amendment is that it's so open to interpretation that if it were enacted, no one knows exactly what would happen, except the one thing we can say for certain is that there would be a lot of litigation over a lot of state laws, some of which are designed to protect farmers, some of which are designed for animal welfare, and some of which are designed for food safety. And this thing would tie up courts for years to come.
Uh-huh. And Brian, why don't you give me your interpretation of the amendment?
Well, the amendment is designed to protect those who are in productive agriculture, mm-hmm. From all the complexity associated with state imposition of trade barriers. It is, in effect, a response to what California did, which it has imposed on the other 49 state producers. It's an unfunded mandate on those producers, the result of which ultimately is an increase of food costs for consumers.
Okay, that was rather opaque, to say the very least. So let's dial it back. And say,
do I get to be excellent too? John was.
Yeah, because I want you to clarify.
And I understand that, and everyone who knows him told me he's excellent as well.
He is excellent, and I'm told you're excellent too. So I'm just going to I'm going to put that to rest right now. You are excellent for even being on this program. So I really appreciate your participation. Now, I want to dial this back, and I want you to explain what you mean by California, and because California passed a proposition that mandated the use of more humane, or if you want to use it another way, larger cages for their poultry operations, meaning that an animal, and this didn't apply just to chickens, but it applied to veal, calves, et cetera, and gestation crates for pigs. And it said that an animal has the right to stand up, turn around, lie down, and have space to do all of those things in their cages, which under many other laws, which don't have such stringent animal welfare regulations, is not a mandate. So what this law, what you're saying is that California, because they have this more progressive, I can call it that, right? More progressive animal welfare statute about
It's progressive unless you're a consumer, yes.
Okay. Frankly, I'm quite in tune with what consumers believe, and we'll talk about that in a second.
No, I understand that.
Yeah.
As am I.
And I think consumers really, they may want cheap food, but they also want good animal welfare standards. And so the California animal welfare standards are higher than, say, in the state of Iowa, which is a big egg-producing state and a big pork-producing state. And so Representative King, of course, being an Iowan representative, is obviously going to look out after the interests of his own state agricultural producers. So what this law says, and John, you will correct me if I'm wrong, what the King Amendment is saying is that other states should not be required to rise to the level of higher animal welfare standards than exist at the federal level, which, let's be honest, are not the greatest. Right? I mean, animal welfare standards that are mandated by the feds basically mean the 26-hour law of resting, which means that an animal must be rested, watered, and fed every 26 hours on the way to slaughter. And the other one is that it has to be insensible before slaughter. Those are the only two mandated federal regulations about animal welfare.
Yeah.
Well, right. There are no federal.
What the King Amendment. Oh, go ahead, John. I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, thank you. There are no federal standards for the housing of animals that set standards for how much space they should have or anything like that. So that's correct. So Brian and I probably don't agree on the interpretation of the King Amendment. He'll be shocked to hear that, I'm sure.
But I know he will be.
Congressman King,
we both agree that we're missing the NFL, though, Katie.
Well, that's
oh, my God. My heart beats for you.
You've got a better time slot.
I am. I'm actually moving my show to Mondays at noon next
now
year.
Now, that's excellent.
Anyway, yeah.
I was afraid she was going to say Monday night, and we'd be back at the same
time. That would be really bad, yeah. But let's face it, watching sports is a colossal waste of time, and Americans really shouldn't be wasting their time watching freaking sports. Play sports? Yes. Watch sports? No. Okay. Let's get rid of these inflated salaries, et cetera. But that's another show. So, boys, let's go back to the essentials here. So what we're talking about is, on your side, Brian, you guys are interested in keeping the lowest common denominator of animal welfare standards, among other things. And John, on your side, you're committed to maintaining the highest standards of animal welfare. So how does this impact interstate commerce?
Because the King Amendment says, the King Amendment lets California dictate standards to California producers, which I believe they have a right to do, even if whether I agree or disagree with what the dictates are. Where we get cross is when California starts trying to dictate the practices of farmers in other states. Both sides in this debate are claiming the state's rights issue.
Right.
We don't think that a state has a right to dictate to producers in other states how to produce safe food. But again,
okay, we're talking about two different things.
We're
talking about animal welfare right now. We're going to talk about food safety in the next half. Okay, so let's stick with just the animal welfare part.
And California isn't telling Iowa how to raise eggs. They're saying that if you want to sell eggs in California, we want them to meet a certain standard.
Right.
But Iowa, if they don't want to meet that standard, or if a particular farm doesn't want to meet that standard, they still have 49 other states to sell their food in.
Yes.
And this all stems from a ballot measure, Proposition 2, that was passed in 2008 by California voters that said that the egg-laying hens had to have enough space to, you know, be able to move around, flap their wings, and have more reasonable amounts of space.
Right.
And then follow-up legislation that the state legislature passed that said that they wanted the eggs that are sold at the supermarkets to be also meeting that humane standard.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we were talking about what consumers want earlier. Proposition 2 got more votes in California than Barack Obama did. This is a very popular law.
Yeah.
And I want to point out that the King Amendment, Katie, you read the language earlier.
Yes.
It said
impenetrable.
It said no state or locality should set any standard for any agricultural product. Now, it didn't say California. It said no state or locality.
Yeah.
And it didn't say eggs. It said any agricultural product.
So that's pretty broad.
And it's very broad. So it goes a lot farther than that. And that's why the Iowa Farmers Union, Steve King's home state, Iowa Farmers Union, passed a resolution condemning it. And attorney generals from around the country have come out against it.
Yep.
Because the thing's so broad that it could strike down literally hundreds of laws, some of which even are designed to protect farmers, like catfish labeling laws in some of the southeastern states.
Right. Okay, so Brian, what's your response to that?
Well, you know, the sensitivity of farmers, just to reach into the source of this, is that we have dealt with for decades in what are called non-tariff trade barriers in the international marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
And what they are is contrived standards that are brought up to discriminate against trade. And agriculture has been a huge source of that worldwide, and the United States isn't always innocent in these things. But
okay.
Now we have this new model where we're starting to do it in the states. And if you do it in a big enough state, it is essentially, you know, as a farmer told me, the only thing worse than an unfunded mandate from Washington is an unfunded mandate from Sacramento. Because to deal in the country's largest state, to sell there, in other words, to survive in business, you have to meet the standard that Governor Schwarzenegger signed into law. I love his movies. He probably knows way less about chickens than the three of us. It doesn't matter, but we can't foresee a way that we would tolerate 50 different states all having their own different standards and then moving to localities.
But we already have that.
Why on earth would every city not be able to set arbitrary standards designed to protect a local producer at the expense of a producer from out of state? And you know, John described the sequence of what happened. Yes, the ballot initiative passed,
mm-hmm.
and that's and we have accepted that. But the legislation that passed after that, and some can say, well, that was done to nationalize animal welfare standards. I think most of us have a pretty good idea why it was done. It was done to protect California egg producers who could otherwise not compete with the rest of the producers in the country unless the rest of the producers became as uncompetitive as they are.
Okay.
And that's why you had legislators rush to pass this thing. It wasn't...
Except they did pass it.
It wasn't because John is very effective, and his group is too, but they don't get full credit for that one.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to go into what your mission statement is, but I am going to get to that later on in the program. But to be honest, Brian, I mean, people did pass it because it is a popular measure. Had it not been a popular measure, had people not been willing to pay that extra price, and I'm sure that tariff of, you know, 1 or 2 cents per carton of eggs in order to ensure a better cage system for chickens is not something that people feel all that strongly about versus whether or not these chickens are living in at least the most minimal conditions.
Right.
And well, Katie, the three of us can afford it. And the 2 cents, you know, you can hear 2 cents, you can hear 12%, what Cal Davis said.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the European model where it's 25%, 30-some%, 44%, right before it crashes, and you've got all sorts of new market manipulations to deal with the aftermath of their mandates.
Mm-hmm.
But, Brian, wouldn't you agree
the other place, I don't know why...
Don't talk at the same time, please. One after the other.
The three of us are are consumers just like the rest of the people, and I understand that's your one of your areas of expertise, Katie, but, you know, one of the loveliest things in America is being able to go into a grocery store where there are 40,000 items that we expect to see, and there's every choice in the world. If you want to pay, and it's far more than 2 cents, for cage-free eggs, there they sit, right on the, every consumer who wants to can vote with their pocketbook and do it. Well, the reason they went to the voters was because consumers weren't doing this. So you go through the ballot initiative, and nowhere in the ballot initiative did it said, hey, all of you vote aye if you want your eggs to price to increase 25% or 10% or whatever it's going to be. Again, the three of us can afford it. I mean, it's fine, but it's for us. But there are far more people in America struggling right now than people who aren't struggling.
But I
and
see.
And just go say, hey, let's we're going to raise the price of your food. Is that fine with you? It's fine with some consumers. It's not fine with the body politic.
Okay, let's let John respond.
Sure.
Yeah, sure. Because the egg industry analysts have looked at what the real cost, and I'm talking about here in the United States, with the United States economy and access to feeds for the chickens and the materials that they need for farming here in the United States. And they found that giving the chickens a more reasonable amount of space where they can at least flap their wings caused less of a price increase than what you get with the normal variation in the cost of the feed that they get to the chickens.
Which, by the way, corn has gone way down in price. So the cost of feed for chickens has diminished enormously in the last 9 months.
It absolutely has. But so much of this talk here is about chickens and eggs. But this is about a lot of other things. It's about firewood, for example.
Yes, tobacco.
There are a lot of states that restrict the importation of firewood from certain states that have invasive pests, like the Asian longhorn beetle. And under the King Amendment, a state that wanted to prevent that pest from being brought into their state,
they would
be
not be able to do that.
That standard. That's
yes,
right.
It also impacts the tobacco industry. I mean, I did actually a lot of research for this. It impacts genetically engineered food labeling. It has an impact on, let me take my glasses off here. It would likely discourage states from imposing stricter requirements on their own food safety standards. It would prohibit processing requirements on out-of-state producers. And it gave a great example, one of the articles that I read, which was from Food Safety News, which was an excellent expose on all of this. The state banned contaminated oysters from the Gulf of Mexico unless they are processed to eliminate deadly bacteria. This law has resulted in clear benefits for California residents. Under the King Amendment, Louisiana's law that allows the sale of unprocessed oysters would supersede California's law and restrict California from protecting its citizens. So it's not just chickens and eggs. It's not just whether or not animal welfare standards are high in pork and cattle and poultry, but it also impacts tobacco, feeding arsenicals to chickens, which is allowed in some states and not in others. So all of these hard-fought food safety issues are also going to be rolled back with the King Amendment, which you know is the reason that really caught my attention. Brian, I'd love to have you respond to the food safety issues.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. We have to take a break, you guys.
Sure.
But just after you respond, Brian, we're going to take a quick break.
Okay. Sure. And you know, we've consulted committee staff and other lawyers to get interpretations
Judiciary Committee or Agriculture Committee?
The Agriculture Committee, who don't believe that that is the case. But let's just suppose that is a risk. Look, I've been through the legislative process a number of times. You know, these things are almost never a take it or leave it. Perhaps what I'm hearing is John suggesting that we should modify the King Amendment so that these unintended consequences don't occur. And if that's the case, then we'll end up having a modified King Amendment, which takes care of bona fide discriminatory trade barriers and things that are simply result in increased price of food. And we can take care of that without hurting sanitary and phytosanitary authority of states to regulate.
Okay,
and there is
you also get this is one last thing. Am I on or seat?
Go ahead, Brian. You finish, and then we'll take a break, and then John, I want you to respond. Okay.
Almost every conference report that's written on a major piece of legislation, you have what's called the statement of managers language, where these sorts of details are laid out. the intent of the language, what it's supposed to cover, what it's not supposed to cover, you know, the full intention, where it came from, and that helps clarify a great number of these matters, because if there are unintended consequences, you know, no one on our side wants that either.
Okay, well, I have the last word here, which is we're going to go to break now, but I'm just going to say that the unintended consequences are by no means dealt with in the King Amendment. The language is way too broad, and I think it should be gutted just because it doesn't address the issues of interstate commerce quite as in a detailed way as you promote, Brian, from your side, and which John and I share a concern about. So, Joe, let's go to a quick break, and we'll be right back with our two advocates for and against the King Amendment, which is part at the moment attached to the Farm Bill and which will be debated in the next coming weeks and which has a really big impact on consumers. So stay tuned for more in What Doesn't Kill You. Thanks.
The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Okay, we're back. This is What Doesn't Kill You, and my guests today are John Goodwin from the Humane Society of the United States and Brian Klippenstein. Am I saying that right, Brian?
Klippenstein,
From Protect the Harvest, a group that is on the agricultural side of this debate about the King Amendment, which is otherwise known as the Protect Interstate Commerce Act, currently attached to the Farm Bill, and currently getting a lot of press attention, unlike most agricultural issues, I might add. Most people seem to ignore the level of impact that agriculture has on our country and our GDP. I am not one of those to do that, and so hence this program. So we were just talking about who benefits the most from the King Amendment, and it seems to me that producers who basically want to embrace the lowest common denominator of animal welfare standards, of food safety standards, are the ones who are going to benefit the most from this amendment if it passes.
And no question.
Right. So, John, why don't we talk a little bit about that, and then, Brian, you can respond.
Well, sure. And, you know, first, on the Agriculture Committee lawyers, I've met some of those guys, and they're pretty sharp guys and pretty nice people. But I do want to point out that process-wise, this is an amendment that brings up a lot of very serious Tenth Amendment concerns. We've had the Attorney General of Mississippi come out against it.
Yes.
The Attorney General of Arkansas come out against it. The National Conference of State Legislatures, 14 law professors just put out a study on Friday afternoon.
Yep.
Completely calling out this amendment as being dangerous, and so it really should have gone to at least one hearing in a judiciary committee where constitutional law experts could come and debate and really vet this thing. That never happened. This was added to the Farm Bill after a limited debate in May in the House Agriculture Committee. Now, there is an alternative, though, if someone is worried about there being uneven standards for egg farmers around the country. And that's legislation we supported with,
right, with the United Egg Producers. Yes, thank you.
The largest trade group for the egg industry.
Yeah.
Now, we both gave a little bit. The bill didn't have the cage-free standard that we had asked for. You know, that's the nature of politics. Both sides give a little bit. But it would require that the cages be longer so the hens can flap their wings, that they have perches and other stimulation like that, and also that certain food safety standards be met and labeling standards. And that would set, with the agreement between the industry and the animal welfare groups, one standard across the country. And I think that would be a fine alternative to the King Amendment. The egg industry's, majority of the egg industry's for it, the big trade groups for it, we're for it. It ran into opposition, though, from some groups that were not even going to be affected by it.
The National Cattlemen's Beef Association would be affected by it, as would the pork producers, because included in the standards of welfare that were enacted in California included gestation crates for pork and veal crates for calves. So, in fact, it does.
But the bill at the federal level doesn't have that because it's an amendment to the Egg Products Inspection Act, which is limited to eggs.
And we know how well that federal law has worked. Let's remember the Wright County Egg Farm, in which 380 million eggs were recalled for salmonella contamination from a farm that was just mind-blowing in terms of its failures to recognize basic standards in food safety and animal welfare. Am I right, Brian? Come on. You can't defend them. There's got to be a standard higher than that.
We can't defend any errors or wrongdoing. The standard of...
So they're the lowest common denominator, amigo, and that's what you're defending. You're defending that kind of standard.
No, it's not. Look, it's part of the reason why... this amendment, just to go back to the process for a second, then I'll come back to this. There was an amendment to gut the King Amendment in the House Committee, and it failed 33-13 with a majority of both parties supporting it. You know, the effort to suggest that somehow this is out of the mainstream just doesn't square with that vote in a Congress that isn't particularly bipartisan. This was a overwhelmingly bipartisan vote of support for the King Amendment, which was also included in the draft in the previous Farm Bill. Agriculture has evolved over time in the most extraordinary ways. And the common denominator has always been the ability to do better, to produce more, with fewer inputs, less of a carbon footprint, less land, less water, less feed. And at the same time, in animal agriculture, and I grew up, and this was long before HSUS was a national powerhouse, explaining it to us the virtues of animal welfare, I had a father who just boiled it down to one word, stress, Katie. He said, we want no stress. And he never was talking about stress on the employees or the kids, but on the animals, because... he just wasn't for it, and by the way, it's bad business. And we do not, we dreamt of the day that we would bring animals in out of the weather and away from the bacteria and away from the predators and be able to make sure that they have equal nutrition and fewer medical interventions and lower mortality rate.
Okay, you can't say, I'm going to stop you right there.
By all those measures... which in a program like this we often don't get to. I just want it said that the agricultural community has always done better, and tomorrow is going to be better than today, too, by the way.
Listen, I don't dispute you that there have been tremendous advances in agriculture and that, you know, we owe the agricultural community a tremendous debt. And by the way, that Americans demanded cheap food, and this is something I've said many times in this program, we demanded cheap food, we got cheap food, and now we're pissed off that it's cheap because we don't like the way it's done. So, I mean, there has to be some give and take here.
Yeah.
And so...
Well, you know, we've got John's group, which is, you know, has important priorities.
Yes.
Making demands on agriculture. At the same time, we've got our friends in the green community saying we want them produced on less land with less water, more efficiently, fewer inputs, energy. And often they're in total conflict. And if you're a farmer trying to figure out how to operate, it can be a confusing time.
It definitely can.
Yeah, and the one thing that Brian and I agree on is that tomorrow we want to be moving forward.
Yes.
And we can always do things better. And I think that there has started to be a slight movement in that direction. The veal industry has started to phase out the crates that they can find the baby calves in. A number of states have said that the breeding female pigs can't be kept in the 2-foot-wide gestation crates for their entire gestation cycle. They need to be in a group housing where they can move around.
Right.
And, you know, there's progress being made on these fronts. Unfortunately, the King Amendment was designed not to allow us to continue moving forward tomorrow and trying to do things better, but to stop progress and actually roll back progress. There's not going to be any laws passed in any issue area if this King Amendment passes for quite some time, because these state legislatures, whether it's food safety or the genetically modified issue and, or, you know, animal welfare. These legislatures are going to be confused as to exactly what they can do because this amendment is so broad and open to so many different interpretations.
I agree. I think it should be killed altogether. And I'm with you, John, on the fact that, you know, look, if you want to enact statutes that protect interstate commerce, you know, there is a median way, and it doesn't have to be the lowest common denominator, which is what the King Amendment is looking for. And it doesn't have to be, you know, necessarily California standards, although I would like it if all animal producers did that. And by the way, I'm going to say something about consumers here. People in the agriculture industry live in a bubble. Brian, I've said this before. I went to the National Institute of Agriculture, Animal Agriculture. I gave a talk on that. I did this for the Animal Agriculture Alliance last spring. People in agriculture simply do not understand what consumers are looking for. And one of the highest priorities, and this was in that article at the Huffington Post that John mentioned earlier on Friday, the restaurant industry has done a poll. Animal welfare is one of the highest concerns on consumers' minds. And I second that. And if guys in the agriculture industry do not recognize that what consumers want and that what they are going to vote for with their forks, and this goes all the way down to like where I teach in Bed-Stuy to a food pantry. I teach cooking there, and I'm telling you, even my constituents there are aware of these issues and are looking to buy from companies that do the right thing in terms of animal welfare, and battery cages do not include animal welfare. And I'm just going to say something. I want you guys to close this program on something that I thought was really interesting and something that I've written about for the Huffington Post, which is the polarity between your two sides, which I find incredibly divisive and destructive in terms of moving agriculture forward in a way that benefits all sides. And I'm going to read directly from your site, Brian, which is called, by the way, for my listeners, it's called Protect the Harvest. Animal rights movement in America, led by the Humane Society of the United States, has evolved into a wealthy and successful attack group determined to end the consumption of meat, eliminate hunting, outlaw rodeos and circuses, and even ban animal ownership, including pets, all together. Protect the Harvest was created to fight back and defend American families, farmers, sportsmen, and animal owners from the growing threat posed by the radical animal rights movement. John, would you like to comment on that characterization of your organization?
Well, I hope that my little puppy down the hallway from me that's sitting there listening to this debate doesn't get the idea that I'm against having pets, because I'm certainly not. I encourage people to go down to the shelter and adopt a dog or cat and give them a chance at life, and I'm all for that sort of thing. So we can have more dialogue, though. Brian has certainly been intelligent and polite.
Excellent, really. Excellent, today. Brian, yeah.
There's room for dialogue. It doesn't have to be vitriolic. And look, I know both sides do it. But look, the agreement that we reach with United Egg Producers, I hope, can be a model for how two sides on two polar opposite sides of an issue can come together and compromise and try to come up with something better that's good for both parties. I think it can be done.
Yeah, I think the Humane Society recognizes a contribution to the American GDP that they make. I mean, we can't live without agriculture. I mean, it's a huge part of our gross domestic product. It's a huge part of our way of life. It's part of what we pride ourselves on as American citizens. And, you know, the idea that the agricultural community has kind of shrouded itself in this bizarre bubble of paranoia. And I say this with real depth of knowledge. I mean, I read the trades for the agricultural community literally every day. I am an avid reader of Meeting Place, an avid reader of Drovers. I mean, I get what they're talking about, and I understand what the challenges are, but to shroud yourself in this crazy paranoia about what other people are thinking and blame the consumer if they get sick from foodborne, I mean, it's like nuts. You guys have got to come to the playing table. You got to come down from whatever strange little space that you're occupying and engage with consumers and recognize their demands and start altering your models. And that, because I'm the host of this program and I can say this, is the end of this show.
It's good to control the mic, isn't it?
It's really good. But Brian, I want to thank you so, so much for being such a thoughtful and articulate spokesman on behalf of your constituency. I do hope you'll come back on the show and join me again for another debate. I thought both of you were terrific. I really appreciate it. John Goodwin, you were amazing. And Brian, you were amazing too, just so I'm doling out the praise on
both
sides.
I just want to be excellent, that's all.
You are excellent and amazing, and you're really personable and nice, and I like you a lot, so...
Yeah, well.
So this was great. So thank you both to my guests, John Goodwin and Brian Klippenstein. I'm saying that. I'm sorry.
It's Stein, but I'll answer Stein. Either.
Klippenstein.
No
Klippenstein. I'm so sorry. From Protect the Harvest.
No worries.
And guys, I really appreciate your participation today. Thank you to Tabard Inn, my sponsor, and to my and of course to the Heritage Radio Network. And we'll see you next week. Oh, by the way, one more piece of housekeeping, folks. I am once again moving to Mondays in January. Mondays at noon. I'm taking back the weekends after 5 years. So if those of you who listen live, that's where I'm going. So we'll see you next week with another great episode of What Doesn't Kill You, a history of the meat industry. Should be fun. Stay tuned, or rather, stay tuned for the Mike and Judy Show, Arts and Seizures next. And thanks again for listening. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.